This is the Cloud Ace Podcast, bringing you the latest in cloud security through captivating chats with fascinating cybersecurity experts who are leaving their mark on the industry. Cloud Ace is brought to you by the SANS Institute and hosted by SANS fellow Frank Kim. And now, prepare for departure. We are cleared for takeoff. Here's your captain, Frank Kim.
Hello, and welcome back to the SANS Cloud Ace podcast. Today, I'm really excited to have Steve Tran, who is the CISO at the Democratic National Committee, the DNC, in the United States here. Steve, thanks a lot for joining.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, all right. Well, hey, let's just go ahead and dive right in. And you know, I'd like to start with people's history here a little bit. And you've got a very interesting one. Can you share a little bit about your family history and how, if at all, that influenced your choice of career?
Yeah, sure. So my family came to the United States after the Vietnam War. Without revealing too much, you know, personal details, I dealt with a lot of generational trauma because of the war. I suffered a lot of, you know, physical and emotional abuse, and there were circumstances that led me to find comfort really anywhere. And it so happened I found my solace in computers and magic. Mm-hmm. And I've talked a lot about this in other interviews and podcasts. And it was the early 90s, and a lot of people around me at school were really curious about the internet. And I was really curious about what the internet was because everyone kept talking about it. And everyone wouldn't stop talking about AOL. And I remember walking home from school one day, and I walked up to my front door, and I noticed a free AOL trial disk just hanging in the little bag on the door thing. And I was like, what is this? You know, and I put the two together and I realized, oh, this is a way to get to the internet. And I feel like the rest is history, because once I got on there, I don't know what it was. I just naturally learned how to lie and impersonate chat room moderators. And I would target paid AOL subscribers in those chat rooms, and I would get them to give me their username and password, and that's how I get free internet. So I was phishing a lot at the time, and one thing led to another, and I came across different groups and websites like Hasta La Vista, and I started hacking more, pirating software more, and then I started seeking out people who had shared knowledge, and I wanted to learn more about, again, how to crack software. I learned how to use a Trojan, and one of my favorite tools I used to use a lot back then was something called SUP7. And because I was naturally curious about how all of this stuff worked, I knew who I wanted to speak to about this. And looking back, I can't believe I was really talking to strangers. Today, I have my own family and kids, and I would never want them to do any of that. So I feel like I kind of lucked out that I didn't end up in a really horrible situation. And I kept at it. And I still remember Napster and the Winamp days like it was just yesterday. And being in the cyber world was the only time I felt safe and comfortable. And of course, now that I know what I know now, again, heck no, like I'm watching my kids like a hawk, because you don't know who they're chatting to nowadays. Just because I was able to get by successfully without, you know, running into some major issues, it doesn't mean that's going to be the case 100% of the time. So I'm not trying to glorify or encourage, you know, other people to let their kids talk to strangers with the belief that they're going to gain the cyber knowledge.
Well, hey, Steve, you're really bringing back some memories. I definitely remember the AOL discs and AOL Instant Messenger, and that being my, you know, one of my main modes of communication at that time when it was popular. For sure, remember Napster, Winamp, and so on. And, you know, you mentioned the tie to magic. Now, aside from security, I'm curious, you know, there's a lot of security-related resources online at the time, right? But, you know, were there a lot of magic resources online at the time, too? Because I know you've performed now, fast forward to today, and, you know, some, you know, well-known places in Southern California and stuff, right? So, yeah, how did you learn all of that?
I walked my butt to the local library. I couldn't, and Google wasn't a thing back then. I stumbled across a few magic books from the public library, and I just got hooked. At first, it wasn't as intuitive to me. I'm looking at some of these illustrations, you know, and I'll admit my reading capabilities weren't also so great, But looking back, what I realized was I had resilience. I didn't give up, and I kept at it because I allowed my curiosity to propel me into really learning the material. And one day things just clicked, the light bulb just clicked. And I feel like that still happens today. And I'm sure a lot of people where immediately when something doesn't click, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad thing or that they're not going to eventually get it. I think if people stuck to things, the light bulb will eventually click and just takes that aha moment. So when that aha moment clicked on me, when I came across another book and the illustration was much more intuitive. And then when I kind of saw the magic happening in my eyes, it's funny because at some point I amazed myself, even though I know how the trick is done, I end up amazing myself because I could see how it looks from the spectator's perspective when I'm in front of a mirror and I end up amazing myself. And then from there, that self wonderment just propelled me into more of the art. And as I got older and smarter, I feel like I was like a late bloomer in life. And there was like this intersection where I'm like, oh my gosh, like I get it now. In magic, you're performing and you're essentially deceiving people in an ethical and entertaining way, really, but you're deceiving. And I realized in the cyber world, if you're on the offensive side, you're doing a lot of deceiving as well. So that's when I realized to be a better deceiver as a hacker, the learning the art of magic is a valuable tool set.
Yeah, that connection definitely makes sense. You mentioned social engineering earlier and definitely some parallels with magic there. Now, you know, I'm just really curious about this, the magic part here. Were there any types of tricks that you tended to focus on? Were they card tricks, other tricks? And, you know, who did you practice on? Your friends and family? You know, how did they react to it?
It was a lot of my friends in high school. And it was either in front of a mirror or with friends. I enjoy close-up magic because it allowed me to essentially do impromptu sets anywhere without needing a huge complicated setup like a sage magician would need.
Yeah, cool. Now, you know, with that parallel between, you know, security and magic, you know, I know also that you were in a law enforcement before, right? Before your career in cybersecurity.
That's right. So everything that I've talked about so far was not a career. Yeah, I was extremely misguided and because of my circumstances, but it's not an excuse for my bad behavior, and I own that. My experience didn't become real until I had a candid conversation with the police officer, and I shared a lot of this background with him at the time. And to my surprise, they were looking for someone tech savvy to help with their computer forensics capability. And this was like the early 2000s where computer forensics was cyber, if I remember correctly. And it was only a few years after 9/11, and there were a lot of investments being made to enhance our national security, which started at the federal level, and it trickled down to the state, county, and local levels across the country. So I feel like because of the landscape of the time, it allowed me to enter a workforce where I was able to utilize a lot of my past experience and skill sets to help, you know, with the job duties at that time. And so I got recruited and sold on the dream of after 30 years of service, I would have a nice pension. That's very attractive. And it's way better. It was a way better life than what I had at the time. Cause I didn't have, you know, the best circumstances again, growing up. I didn't have my own place until, you know, I met my wife and got married and, you know, I had this career. I was just bouncing from, you know, people's living rooms, living out of, you know, my suitcase or a portable closet, you know, for most of my life there. And I also saw a sense of patriotism, especially after 9/11. And it was a good fit at the time. But over the years, you know, being in police work, it wore me down. And I eventually got hurt and they had to retire me early. It's something I did not expect. And that's when I transitioned into the civilian world where I got to work for great organizations like Mattel, Fox, Deloitte, and MGM Studios.
Wow. So you were in law enforcement, and then, you know, because of your background in digital forensics, you know, all of that experience, then you were able to, you know, kind of go into the civilian world and take on various cyber roles then, it sounds like.
That's exactly right.
Wow. Now, hey, so you were also the CISO at MGM for, I think it was almost 5 years. Now, looking back, you know, what did that program look like when you started, and what was different when you left?
Well, when I came in, I had no team, no budget, no political capital. It was a greenfield environment for me. A program didn't exist, but there was some controls in place, but there were nowhere near the maturity needed at the time. The department heads were all very supportive, and I was able to get the security buy-in I needed to build my vision, which was to create a security model and program that's tailored for the creative world. And protecting billion-dollar assets like James Bond and the iconic MGM library was very stressful, but I enjoyed the experience a lot.
Now, you know, at MGM, so you built some pretty cool capabilities during your time there, but you were also, which not all CISOs get to do, involved in multiple high-profile M&A activities, both, I think, as an acquirer and, of course, you know, being acquired with the, you know, Amazon, I think it was, what, $8.5 billion, if I remember correctly. You know, can you describe, you know, for those of us that haven't, people that haven't gone through that process, what does that look like, the M&A process from a security perspective look like both pre and post-merger?
Sure. I'll start with what the process looks like when you are the acquirer. When I came on board, this was after MGM had already acquired Epix, I would say, you know, maybe like 5 months before. So I came in not too long after the deal was done. And there was a lot of work that needed to be done on the MGM side to take over a lot of the workflows and infrastructure that Viacom traditionally managed for them. And from the tech and security side of the house, Epix went from being serviced by a formalized team to now MGM. And earlier I had mentioned there was a lot of work that needed to be done already. So adding this on top of all of that was very stressful because I had to quickly figure out how we were going to help support Epix in a short amount of time because Viacom wasn't going to continue supporting them post-merger. And there was a lot at stake because we were facing stiff penalties if we didn't get off their infrastructure within a set deadline during the M&A process. But in the end, you know, we all rallied together and got the job done. It was not easy at all. It took, you know, multiple trips to New York, all-nighters. But I would say the best decision I made was to leave Epix alone and not force them to go backwards to the tech MGM was using at the time because Epix was further along in their tech and innovation capabilities. So I used them really as a driver to help level up the parent organization. I know a lot of times the common things we hear is, well, if a company acquires another company, that they expect the acquired company to be exactly like the parent organization. But I feel like if ego got in the way and we took that approach and forced them to be like us, it would have led to really bad outcomes. Because what you want to avoid is acquiring an organization and squeezing them so tight that you end up putting them out of business.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I took the same approach for, you know, the other companies we acquired over the years and built really great partnerships that lasted us until Amazon came along. And then now we became the acquiree.
You know, I was just going to ask you, maybe you're about to get into this too. You know, a lot of times when this M&A activity happens, a lot of it is kind of maybe a little secretive and a little hush-hush. And, you know, I've been in situations where, you know, as the security leader, I don't even necessarily know until it's close to the finish line that this is happening. But sounds like, you know, you went through so many of them, you've got to have a robust process. How did you think about involving your team during this process?
What I've always advocated for is less gatekeeping. And you're right, a lot of times this is hush-hush. And I was very fortunate that our leadership got us involved early in the process because it's very intimidating because you don't want to be the person or the reason why the deal falls apart during the merger process or things get leaked out to the press and it could affect the overall deal. And people, you know, tend to lose their minds when over $8 billion is at stake. And I appreciate that. And I understand why. But, you know, during the pre-merger process, there's a ton of work and documentation gathering that needs to happen at all levels and from every department. So it's really important to build a well-structured and secure process of how both companies would share and collaborate on data. So, you know, finding things like how you would set up a data clean room really mattered at that time. And, you know, I would say what I didn't know, wish I knew, is like, you know, what are some of the etiquettes, I guess you can say, or what the expectation is and who should be involved, who should be involved. Because of the lack of clarity, I kind of made my best judgment on, you know, I'd rather have people have information sooner rather than later. Especially if I anticipated that post-merger, that their day-to-day work or their role would radically change. The last thing I wanted to do was traumatize them. And, you know, they would encounter that like out of nowhere, to your point, right? They find out when it's all said and done. And all of a sudden, what they're used to doing year after year is now radically change overnight. That could be, you know, really harmful to kind of like their mental state, but then also to like their career and ultimately livelihood. Because, you know, we all have ourselves and our families to take care of. And I'm always thinking about people first, you know. Even though $8 billion was at stake, yeah, I feel like we could have a good balance between commercial and, you know, doing the right thing and taking care of people first. And it really worked out well because they were able to acclimate during the post-merger process much quicker, much more seamless. And today they're doing really well. You know, none of them have gotten laid off, which is great. And yeah, I'm really proud of them because I allow them to have an opportunity to learn and grow, you know, from this perspective too, from what an individual contributor could do during a M&A process. It's not just the business executives. So I'm really proud that I allowed them to have an opportunity to learn something like this that is really rare for a lot of individual contributors, because a deal like this doesn't come, you know, that often, you know, or every day. So even if I was going to get chastised for it, it was worth it in my opinion, because again, I'm always looking to help broaden our talent pool and to help level everyone up, because I feel like in the future we would be better off for it when we allow more inclusiveness, you know, within, you know, all types of projects, including like a big merger and acquisition activity like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great approach and great experience for the team. Now, in terms of that experience, you were talking about as the acquirer, you know, as the acquirer, what type of technical due diligence did you commonly ask the team to do? And then compare that to when being acquired, was there a different type of due diligence, technical due diligence that you saw that you had to experience from the other side of the table?
It's not too different. I would say the difference is you either walk into a room knowing that, you know, you own the process and like you're the big boss versus, okay, I'm trying to make a good impression because I may want to stay on post-merger, you know? So I would say that's probably the biggest dynamic change. Because I think traditionally when you're the one being acquired, you don't know if you're going to have a job post-merger and acquisition. So everyone behaves differently along that context because they want to make a good impression and to be involved and, you know, to secure their future post-merger. But when you're the acquirer, it's like another day for you. And what you really want to, from a security perspective, you want to make sure that you give the C-level, you know, the best information you can at the time so they can make the best decision that they can make. You know, it's all different than building out a SOC garbage in, garbage out mentality, right? Because, you know, if you're the acquirer and you're going through this due diligence process and you realize that there is something that could be material, like that's the most important thing is like, you know, what could be material to an organization post-merger? And you want to bring that to light so that it could be addressed before everyone signs on the dotted line there. Because, you know, two common outcomes like the cabin one, the final price changes because, you know, if we're going to have to make a lot more investments to get them to an acceptable level, then why are we going to pay you know, at a higher rate if we can get done at lower rate to be able to compensate for that. Or two, the deal just doesn't happen at all because the risk could be too great and so it would not be worth it. And so being the acquiree and Amazon coming in, you know, with the level of due diligence they were doing, from my perspective, was very validating that the programs, policies, and controls you put in place was good enough for them. Because at the time, you know, you have your vision, you're trying to implement your vision, but, you know, I always feel like a good, you know, barometer or measuring stick is when someone objective from the outside come in and giving the feedback. Because I can self, you know, attest all day long and think, you know, we're, you know, all that, but it's all about reality, you know, is how we perceive ourselves reflective of reality.
Yeah, you're exactly right. It could be very hard to self-assess, you know, when you're in the forest trying to, you know, build a cabin yourself. It's a little hard to see the big picture. Now, with the benefit of hindsight, if you look back, you know, in all those years at MGM, you know, you had a little bit of that external validation at the end, but, you know, what are the things that you guys built that you're the most proud of?
Well, I'd say what I'm most proud of was when I built the team, almost everyone except for one person was brand new to cybersecurity. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to hire someone off the shelf, but I was also looking to build for the future too. I didn't want to also bring in someone that was only going to stay like a year, a few months, and then bounce to the next opportunities because the demand is so high, right? Like, I don't blame them. When the market's high, you go to where the opportunities are. But I was looking to build something more long-term, so I figured the best way to do that is to find someone who's had a hard time breaking through the first barrier because naturally I'm a teacher and I'm an adjunct instructor on the side still because I have such a huge passion for education because education has helped me throughout my life, especially during my very low moments. It's teachers that lift us up. And I feel like I've had some experience where I had really awesome teachers that went out of their way. And again, it just planted enough of a seed for when I knew a good opportunity would come up that could turn my life around, I was able to take it versus, you know, heading down and staying in a really dark path. So I took that approach at MGM where, you know, I built a model really off the NICE framework because if we don't have to reinvent the wheel, like, why do that? So I was very fortunate to have resources like, you know, the NICE framework available to me where I can look, okay, cool, this is the world we build out, this is the skills needed, this is how we can get there. And if we wanted someone to get a particular certification, we would help kind of build that pathway for them so they didn't have to figure it out on their own. Because I know a lot of people will just take any certification that exists out there thinking it's going to bolster their resume, but, you know, it doesn't clearly identify a path for them. So I would say that's the thing I'm most proud of is, you know, building a program that's, you know, formalized off of, you know, all the cool lessons learned from this and the NICE framework. And then, you know, matching that with the workforce and then getting them set up. And from a tech innovation perspective, I would say, you know, allowing MGM to explore the Web3 world. The blockchain R&D project that I started, you know, was very critical because it not only allowed MGM to just do business as usual, but to also have one foot in the future as well, because then, you know, they would have options and where they can go with it. Because if you're trying to innovate and help an organization disrupt, you know, you definitely want to make sure that you can survive and take care of the day-to-day issues, the here and now issues, but like give us some optionalities for the future.
Yeah, great. Hey, you kind of pre-answered my next question in terms of, you know, hey, how do you talked about kind of maybe taking a chance on some people and hiring folks who didn't have the experience necessarily, but were looking for the opportunity. And, you know, you talk about the NICE framework and getting them up to speed on various capabilities, right? Really building that expertise kind of for your team members, you know, especially around probably cloud, I'm guessing, right? And, you know, kind of switching topics here a little bit. You know, you were at MGM for about 5 years. I think, if I remember correctly, you wound up leaving sometime after the acquisition, and you made the leap to the Democratic National Committee. Kind of, what made you jump from MGM over to the DNC?
I would say the biggest driver is I started my career in public service, and you know, because I got hurt and I had to be retired early, it just put me in the place where I'm always going to have that bug that's like, mm-hmm. you know, that's nagging at me to, you know, continue thinking about public service. And I knew I couldn't go back to that world. So when I found out about the opportunity here, I felt like this is something that could address my need to go back into public service. And especially at a very critical time where the landscape is getting more volatile. It's radically shift from years before. And I feel like I'm just so used to running into the fire or into a burning building that, you know, I just felt like it was a good time for me to get involved and help improve, you know, our election security, national security, just the cybersecurity as a whole, and see how I can help rally everyone together to, you know, preserve a great country.
Yeah, amazing. You know, I'm curious, you know, in terms of kind of the threat actors, you know, you've been at many businesses, different types of industries in the past. Kind of with the DNC, what do you see that's different in the threat landscape and the threat actors that maybe you need to think about from a CISO perspective?
I would say I went from protecting storytellers, and a lot of people, you know, would say, oh, you're just protecting movies and television content. But to me, in my heart, it was much more than that, because we all know the power of storytelling and how it could really lift, you know, diverse communities. When you think about how you got into your career or how other groups got into career, it doesn't matter what it is, whether you're a doctor, scientist, astronaut, whatever. A lot of times people can look back and connect to a piece of story that they encountered, whether it's like a book, movie, or whatever, that got them down that path or that inspired them to go down, you know, that path. So to me, everything that I did was to protect storytelling, because I knew the collective good it could do for the world. So over here, you know, I take the similar approach. What are the things we care about? You know, and within my organization, it's the progressive mission. And I think about all the ways that we can protect, you know, the work they do to achieve that mission. And when I think about my threat actors, like I would say it's a little bit more intuitive than before, because before it's like, you know, when you use threat modeling, like who's after me in entertainment, right? Because a lot of times it's just, you know, financially motivated attackers. Here, you know, I would say less financially motivated attackers and more nation state sponsored attackers. I have more hacktivism, I would say. So then now when I think about the programs, policies, and controls we put in place, it's to counter those type of opposition.
Yeah, the way you framed it is really inspiring, Steve. And you know, you mentioned earlier about, you know, teaching and being a adjunct professor. Now, you know, speaking of that inspiration, you've been teaching cybersecurity, right, at both the high school and college level for some years now. How did that start? How'd you get into that?
You know, having kids totally changed, you know, starting my career changed my life from where I was before. And when I thought my life couldn't change anymore, it changed a lot when I had kids. And when I look at them and they're getting much older now, and I'm just, you know, I just want, I think about other families and other people's children. And, you know, I just wanted to do something where I feel like I could help others, really. And I think that was the biggest thing. And then the byproduct of that too, could really help broaden our talent pool. I think, you know, from the trauma I deal with every day, the thing about PTSD and some of the mental health issues is there's no cure, you know, and to this day, I try really hard to fight, you know, some of the mental health issues that I have. And I feel like this helped manage that. But then I would say ultimately, you know, I remember there was a time where I felt like there was no hope. So by getting involved, you know, in, you know, the K-12 space and the community college space, I feel like I could give a lot of those students who may have come from my similar backgrounds to have some kind of hope and inspiration that, you know, they could have a meaningful career that can put them in another class that they never imagined they could obtain. Because the class that I live in today is so radically different than the generations before me. Yeah.
Man, Steve, thanks so much for being so candid about, you know, kind of your personal journey and, you know, the things that you've experienced. You know, it takes a lot of courage to do that and get to that point. You know, do those things ever come up in the classroom? I mean, certainly kind of your passion for helping, you know, the next generation get to the next place in life, that clearly comes through. But, you know, what do you find resonates the most with these the students?
I would say just breaking through the stereotypes, you know, that they see, especially when you're, you know, helping students come from underserved communities, where a lot of times the surroundings convince them that this is like their path, right? And what I like to do in the classroom is, you know, when I'm looking at my students, like, it's so diverse, right? From age to race, religious beliefs, gender, you know, affiliations and things like that. And, you know, the one common theme that we all talk about is how achievable this can be for them. Because I think a lot of them go in the classroom, they all hear about this from different, you know, channels. But to hear, for them to hear it from me saying, hey, like, you belong and all that stuff, I think, you know, the one thing that resonates with everyone's like, hey, like, I didn't think I would have a future, but because I took this class, I feel like I have a future. And it's just coming from all walks of life.
That's amazing. The, you know, and I mean, even just, you know, hey, your personal story and journey, but also, you know, just, hey, there's not always people that look like us in front of the classroom, right? So I think just being around people that, from different backgrounds, like you said, and seeing what's possible, seeing that it's possible is very powerful. You know, you're also the founder of an organization called Silicon Scholars. You know, tell us about that. What's the goal of the organization?
It's still my personal mission to, again, continue along these barriers. Then I started to recognize that, you know, not everyone can, well, one, afford college, but then even community college could be out of reach for certain people. And sometimes, I mean, I appreciate the fact that college and formalized education is just not for everybody. So I'm trying to, you know, address a market where, you know, we have students that, you know, don't think college is for them. But a lot of, like, the cyber programs today, you know, involve some kind of college, you know, whether if it's not a 4-year, then it's a 2-year. But then, you know, what if they don't want to go through a 2-year program? So I'm just trying to, like, continue to make this more accessible to people. So the organization is designed to address, you know, people who don't want to get involved in college, or they feel like college is not for them, but it could be a pipeline to college. And then also try and get to a younger age, because I know they're quite capable, because I did it. And also for adults who are looking for a second career, but they may already have a 4-year degree in, you know, something that's non-computer related, but is it realistic for us to get them to go back to college there another year just to get a job in their field? So, you know, I'm trying to create these various pipelines to help people get into the field and industry a lot more intuitively and a lot more achievable, where, you know, it's, again, making it definitely accessible from a financial standpoint.
Yeah, that's great. That makes sense. Now, is it classes that you're offering on certain topics, specifically in cyber, or is it kind of hooking them up with other opportunities? How's that set up?
Yeah, it's going to be a little bit of everything. It's a program that's designed to get people introduced to computers that may not be comfortable with just computer in general, because I think a lot of times we make assumptions, even with the younger generations, that they are technically savvy, but they're not. And it makes sense if you have a lot of academic programs or curriculum that still has incorporated a lot of the STEM, you know, courses in there. So why would you expect the younger generations to be technically savvy if you're not offering computer fundamentals in high school?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, when I looked at the statistics, it was pretty alarming. And I would have realized that just because they're great on social media and on a mobile device, that doesn't mean that when you give them a desktop, they would know how to use Microsoft Word, as an example, or spreadsheets and things like that. And, you know, because, you know, being in where I am right now, IT rolls up under my organization, and I'm just looking at, you know, their help, the type of help desk request that comes in and how we can improve our metrics and things like that. And what's really alarming is, you know, a good chunk of our workforce are in the younger generation, in their early 20s, right, or after college. And I'm looking at some of these tickets. I'm like, no way did they make this request. I mean, they should know how to use some of this stuff. And then I realized, oh, that was my own personal bias and assumption. But when I really looked at the statistics and the reasons why, it motivated me again to create this organization, because there's no excuse why the younger generation shouldn't be technically savvy. And I think, you know, if we were to improve, to make the digital world more secure and safer, I would say it takes a lot of investments, and I'd say media literacy. We're seeing it right now. You get a lot of people that can't tell the difference between the video game footage and real life footage. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of misinformation and disinformation that's happening right now. So I think it's really important to teach a younger generation, not only like computer fundamentals and how they could apply the skills in our workforce, but then to their own personal lives too. And then just really build more digital citizens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, you're speaking about the maybe the gap in understanding with the younger generation and us taking maybe some things for granted. I've got a 4-year-old, and, you know, normally he's on touchscreen devices when he's using them. And he was looking at something on my laptop, and he naturally, of course, goes to touch the screen. And I had to kind of try to explain to him, oh, well, this one's not a touchscreen, and you have to use the trackpad, right? So even simple, little things like that, right? You gotta take it for granted.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely. But again, it just goes back to why I went to teaching. And this is just another, you know, distribution channel for me to kind of share my own personal experiences. Because I always hear, you know, students saying, wow, like, I did not expect you to be so, you know, down to earth and not so formal. Because everyone looks at my title and they just think, they're just expecting me to come in and being very, you know, suit and tie, very formal about everything and well polished. But the reality is, it's, you know, I went through the same struggles like a lot of people do in these different communities. And I just wanted to be that proof, the example that just because you're in the state now doesn't mean that this will be your end state.
Yeah. Well, hey, you're definitely an advocate for, you know, helping the next generation and trying to get them to help them take the next step. And, you know, what do you think it would take to, you know, maybe even get more people at scale, more people from diverse backgrounds into cloud and cybersecurity?
Yeah, I would say, one, we need to stop with the gatekeeping and making ourselves feel better that we're smarter than they are, right? I mean, I just remember looking back earlier in my career, you know, how uncool, you know, it was for me to kind of share like the work that I was doing, because people were like, oh, you're just a nerd, right? And it was very kind of lonely, I would say, in the early days. I'm not sure if you went through something similar, but I feel like we're at a state now where our field is cool. It's, you know, being talked about everywhere and a lot. And I just never imagined the career, I mean, how that career like evolved to what it is today. And if people are really interested, like, why are we going to make it harder for them? We don't want to turn them away, because I don't want to go back to that lonely early days where no one wanted to be in this field. If people want to be in this field, like, we have to constantly find ways to get them in, and but not only get them in, but to keep them in. Use CTF as a perfect example. I just, you know, I kind of, you know, lost appreciation for how I got started. It was like, you know, I would say a lot of hours and sleepless nights, and it was really hard, right? But just because it was hard for us, does it mean that it has to be hard for them? No, like we have really advanced sophisticated technology today, but yet we can't figure out how to continue lowering barriers to get people in and to keep their interest. You know, and I just realized with CTS, it's like, man, we make it really complicated every time we do one of these things. Yeah, but like it wasn't until, you know, the US Cyber Games where I feel like that's a game changing approach where it's like, oh, why don't we make challenging a little less crazy? But we turn up the stress by the speed and pace of which, you know, they have to solve the problem. Just because you can solve now that problems are created where it can be solved in like 45 minutes or less versus like a week, right? It doesn't dilute or take away from the objective of building cyber talent. They'll eventually get there, but you know, we can't get there. We don't think about the upstream, how we make the upstream much better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and you're definitely right. The field is, you know, exciting. People are interested in security and of course technology, you know, of course with the web and cloud and, you know, now AI. And, you know, I guess, you know, one last thing that I want to ask you here is kind of, what are you most excited by in security overall, whether it's new capabilities, tools, techniques? You know, what are there things that you're having your team think ahead for, plan ahead for, and kind of get ready for?
Yeah, I would say when we can get more people into this field from different, you know, diverse backgrounds in terms of like thinking, you know, because there's a lot of smart people in this world, and I don't think, you know, we're addressing that and being more inclusive in that part. And I feel like, you know, when we can get the right people into the field, it could lead to radically different outcomes than we could ever imagine. Mm-hmm. You know, when you think about, you know, inspiring leaders of the past, right? Would they have become that inspiring leader if they couldn't break through that initial barrier? You know, so I'm constantly fantasizing about, you know, someone who's going to be the next game changer in our field. Because I think there's a lot of conversation already going around AI safety, security, and ethics, and just cloud security, maturity, and all of that. But I think what I'm most excited about is like, you know, someone who can come in to radically change our mental model as a whole. And how we look at security. That's what I'm always trying to chase down when I'm on, you know, Mastodon and some of the social media is, you know, I just feel like we've done a lot of things the same way for so many years. So I'm just looking for someone to come in and radically change our mental model.
Yeah, I love that. I love the focus on the mindset. That's great. All right, hey, we're going to go ahead and switch gears now and kind of take us, before we close, I'm going to give you the opportunity to ask me any question you like, a little bit of a reverso around. So hopefully you remembered the reverso around here. So yeah, I'll let you take it away.
Yeah, I want to hear more about, you know, your background, how you got into this field.
Yeah, you know, this is something that I've shared in other places before or some elements of it. And, you know, it was a totally by accident. You know, I encountered my first computer virus back in the day. My parents, many years, you know, I would have to go to the computer library or, you know, use a friend's computer because we didn't have one. And fast forward many years later, my dad got an x86 variant, and it was a dot matrix printer and an orange monochrome monitor and a 5.25-inch floppy drive. And, you know, this was before the internet. And I had no way to get software. And of course, hey, I didn't want to pay for it because we didn't have any money. And so I went to school and I talked to some other classmates who I knew had computers. And I said, hey, do you have any software for this computer? I just got it. And I should have been a warning sign. Immediately, out of his backpack, he pulls out a 5.25-inch floppy disk and says, here you go. And so, you know, me not knowing anything about security and not being wary, I go home and pop, slide it in, and I close the little lever to keep it in place, copy over the files and run some software. And fortunately, it was a benign virus that he introduced. It would play Mary Had a Little Lamb over and over on a loop on the little tinny speaker. And it took me forever to figure out how to get rid of that, you know, and, you know, using the DOS prompt and everything. And I went back to school and he saw him a few days later and he's like, hey, so what happened? How'd the software go? And he was expecting me to complain about the little music virus. But I was like, no, everything's fine. And he looked at me quizzically and, you know, that was that. And I think maybe as a kid, that was one of the things that first got me kind of thinking about it, into it. But I didn't actually start in security proper. You know, I started as a developer, engineer, building applications, kind of in the early days of the web. And you know, short story is I wrote a bunch of bad code that I had to then figure out how to fix. And that's basically what got me into security.
Nice, nice. I love hearing other people's story. And I would love, now the follow-up question to that is because the reason why I like hearing other people's story is to also showcase that there is a linear pathway to this field, right? Would you agree?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, even day-to-day, week-to-week, right? You know, years ago, you know, even though I had taken computer classes in school and everything, you know, what they didn't teach me at the time was software development. So I get my first job and I'm kind of expected to know all these things about software development and just kind of have to pick it up on the fly. And then even in security, you know, I remember starting to use the cloud for the first time. And, you know, even though I had a coding background, I was like, oh, now I got to write a bunch of cloud formation code and infrastructure code and figure out how to do that and understand the alphabet soup of all of the AWS services and what they all mean. And yeah, it's definitely a learning curve here. So it's definitely true that it's for sure not linear. And even from a day to day, right? It's, you know, not linear as well. It's only when I look back kind of across the big picture, maybe months or even years, you know, I can kind of say, and I'm like, no, personally, I've got that's something I could personally improve on, because every time I do something or maybe accomplish something, I think, okay, what's next? What's the next thing? Where instead of taking a moment to kind of appreciate kind of what's actually happened before and what it took to get to that point.
Yeah. What would you say is the biggest need in the next 3 years in our field?
Yeah, really good question. You know, you had such great answers to kind of that theme. So I'm trying not to repeat the same thing here. But I think the biggest need would be kind of filling the top of the funnel with people who are kind of curious and have some sort of interest. I mean, if we're talking about security in particular, I think it's that curiosity and desire to kind of figure out how things work. And it doesn't mean, and a lot of those people that they have that inclination or desire to constantly learn, but then they don't necessarily know that security is a field that's an option. You know, as a kid, I had no idea. You know, I was, you know, the month before graduating, I had no idea what I wanted to do. You know, I just, you know, probably didn't take the time enough to think about what career options there were. And so I think it's just making people aware that this is an interesting and fun area, but then, you know, trying to find people that have perhaps not just an aptitude, but an interest or a potential, right, interest in it, filling that top of the funnel, I think will be really important. You know, one of my daughters is a Girl Scout, you know, and of course, hey, a few years ago, they introduced the cyber badge, right? So there's these small things happening, right, throughout society where hopefully we'll continue to fill the top of the funnel.
Okay. And I have this really important question for you. It's a question that here internally at the DNC, we must ask of.
Oh, you got me nervous now.
What is your favorite ice cream?
Favorite ice cream. You know what? I'm a little bit weird. I can tell you my favorite fruit immediately, right? Which is watermelon. And there's an ice cream shop that closed down some years ago in nearby here where I live in Berkeley. And I would eat any ice cream flavor that they had. And one of them, it's an oddball flavor, but it was rosemary and pine nut flavor. And I would get that one. I would get that all the time. So yeah, it's not your typical answer, but it was only the one made by them, which was really good.
Interesting. What does that taste like? I can't imagine what that would taste like.
Well, and you know, rosemary can be a little bit concentrated, right? A little bit strong. But they were skillful at making the ice cream. So yeah, it had that light kind of rosemary flavor. And then, you know, pine nut is a little bit of a delicate flavor too. So yeah. Yeah.
Interesting. Could you still find that flavor today?
I have never seen it anyplace else. Yeah. And they would only do it every once in a while. It was like seasonal when they would make it. So I was so sad when it closed down. I would go there and take the kids there, and we'd get a burrito first, finish the burrito, and then go get ice cream to finish off the food coma.
Well, if I run across a favorite, I'll be sure to get you some.
Yeah, yeah. Well, wait. So I got to ask you, what's your favorite?
Ooh, it's very controversial. Very, very controversial. Every time I say mint chocolate chip, people go crazy. I don't know why.
Crazy in a positive or negative way? Because I love mint chocolate chip. growing up eating as a kid from the supermarket, you know, mint chocolate chip has to be green colored, right? I know it's artificial, but it's got to be green.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my favorite memories is just going into a Thrifty's and getting the mint chocolate chip on the squared scooper onto that cone. Uh-huh. You know, can't beat that.
Awesome. Well, hey, Steve, with that, let's go ahead. We can go ahead and wrap up the show here. Really appreciate you coming on and sharing all of your experiences, your personal journey. Again, hey, thanks for being so candid and courageous with all of your experience. You know, I think people are going to love hearing this episode. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Shane. Appreciate you giving me an opportunity to share my story.